Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Coming up, a huge procession of Shiites from all over Iraq makes its way to the holy city of Najaf to mourn the death of a top cleric killed in last week's terrorist bombing. On a new tape, reportedly of Saddam Hussein, denies responsibility for the attack. We'll have a report from Iraq. Also, on this Labor Day, we talk with one former high-tech worker who, despite his best efforts, has been out of work for more than 2 years.
Sometimes I do feel humiliated. It's embarrassing when I meet other friends or friends of my girlfriend and they say, John, you're not working yet? Or even my retired parents don't quite understand the situation.
These stories and the biography of Blue Note Records coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Bush says the tax cuts he advocated have set the stage for an economic recovery that will improve the employment picture in the United States. Mr. Bush told union members at a training center in Richfield, Ohio today that creating new jobs is one of his top concerns.
We've done a lot to lay the foundation for economic growth, and there's a lot we can do when Congress gets back to make sure that this economic recovery continues so people can find work on Labor Day.
The event in Ohio is the first in a week in which the president will try to build support for his economic policies. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao today acknowledged that the economic recovery is not yet as strong as had been hoped. The nation's unemployment rate is at a 9-year high, with 9 million Americans looking for work. Israeli helicopters fired 4 missiles at a car in Gaza City today, killing at least one militant from the Islamic Hamas movement and wounding at least 25 others. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
It was the 6th Israeli missile strike on members of the Islamist Hamas movement in the past 2 weeks, which have killed a total of 12 Hamas militants and 3 bystanders. Palestinian officials said the man targeted today was a member of the Hamas military wing. Witnesses said the missiles hit a small car as it was driving in a crowded side street in downtown Gaza City. Earlier, Israel's chief of staff told the Israeli cabinet that the army is ready to launch a ground strike in the Gaza Strip if the firing of Qassam rockets continues. A Qassam hit the Israeli coastal city of Ashkelon last week, and Israeli officials charged the Palestinian Authority has done nothing to stop Hamas. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The FBI is now assisting in the investigation of the car bombing in Najaf in Iraq last week that killed scores of people, including a prominent Shiite Muslim cleric. An FBI spokesman says the agents will provide forensic analysis of the wreckage left by the blast. NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad says a number of suspects are being questioned.
There have been conflicting reports as to how many people they have detained. The governor of Najaf saying over the weekend that a number of people, perhaps 4 or 5, all of Iraqi nationality, had been held. The FBI has also been working with the Iraqi police on the bombings of the Jordanian embassy last month, as well as the bombing of the United Nations headquarters in Baghdad last month. Iraqi police have said the type of bomb used, believed to be a car bomb, in Najaf on Friday was similar to those previous bombings.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Baghdad. The first hurricane to hit Hawaii in a decade is churning just south of the Big Island, and residents are bracing for heavy rains and waves up to 15 feet high. Hurricane Ximena is weakening, though. Its winds are just barely above hurricane strength. The stock market is closed for the Labor Day holiday. This is NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, Treasury Secretary John Snow is in Tokyo today for meetings this week with his Japanese counterpart and the country's prime minister. U.S. business and labor groups have urged him to take a tough stance on trade issues. One group, called Coalition for a Sound Dollar, claims that both Japan and China are keeping the value of their currencies artificially low, giving them an unfair trade advantage that's hurting U.S. businesses and costing Americans jobs. The markets closed today for the Labor Day holiday. Wall Street will be trying to build upon 6 months' worth of gains when trading resumes tomorrow, as NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
Wall Street is coming off another solid week. The Dow Jones Industrials ended Friday up nearly 42 points to close at 9,415.82. For the week, the Dow rose 0.7%. The Nasdaq gained more than 2.5% for the week, while the S&P 500 was up 1.5%. August also marked six consecutive monthly gains for the Dow and the S&P 500. For the Nasdaq, it's now seven straight positive months. Among the economic data being watched this week by Wall Street, factory orders and construction spending for July, the Federal Reserve's Beige Book on regional economic conditions, and Friday's report from the Labor Department on the nation's unemployment rate for August. July's jobless rate of 6.2% was a nine-year high. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
School districts are placing orders for a new product aimed at getting children to drink more milk. It's a slightly carbonated beverage called Power Milk, created by a registered nurse in New York State who said it pained her to see students guzzling cola and shunning milk. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the N.E.E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is off today. It's Here and Now. Saddam Hussein has purportedly sent a new tape to the Arabic news channel Al Jazeera. On the tape, Hussein denies any involvement in the killing of Ayatollah Mohammed Bakir Hakim last week, and he calls those who are pointing the finger at him hissing serpents spitting venom. Ayatollah Hakim was killed by a massive car bomb after Friday prayers. He was a moderate cleric who urged his people and younger clerics to work with American forces to build a more democratic Iraq. Hakim's body was destroyed by Friday's blast. Since yesterday, crowds of Shia mourners have been gathering across Iraq in a funeral procession bearing an empty coffin to the holy city of Najaf. Well, joining us from his car cell phone in Baghdad is Neil Mafarquhar of the New York Times. And Neil, the funeral procession for Ayatollah Hakim began yesterday in Baghdad. You saw it then. It's still going on. Can you describe the procession? How large is it? You know, what are people doing?
It's an unusual procession in that, usual Muslim burial rites are done very quickly on the very day of death or the day afterward. And this one is taking 3 days. And it's because it's as much a political rally as it is a spiritual journey. The Shiites want to show by the emotional outpouring that they are a unified, concentrated group who deserve a large political role in Iraq that reflects their numbers. And it's a spiritual journey because every year they celebrate the martyrdom or the death of Imam Hussein, whose killing on the battlefield led to the founding of their faith. As I said, every year they celebrate it by walking to Karbala. And so they're sort of trying to recreate that. And that brings out the most emotional side in people. They're weeping by the side of the road as the cortege passes, and they're running up to the hearse, which is a long, flat, 18-wheel truck, and they're handing up stones or pieces of cloth or paper to the clerics who are standing around the coffin, and they rub it on the coffin and then hand it back, and then it becomes sort of this blessed token.
In the immediate aftermath of the killing, we spoke to a friend of the program in Baghdad. In fact, we'll be speaking to him again in a moment. He's a Shia. He expressed fear that there would be a bloodbath, Shia against Shia, because there was suspicion that it might have been a younger cleric behind the bombing. What's the feeling today as to who's responsible?
Given the magnitude of the attack, the idea that it might be part of the interclerical rivalry for sort of predominance in the religious political sphere is being discounted because people just can't accept the idea that they would kill nearly 100 people just to eliminate one Ayatollah, nor that they would do it in such a holy place. So it's focusing more now on sort of elements of the deposed Ba'ath regime who, have reason to sow mayhem within the country, or some sort of, foreign involvement who would also be interested in causing the United States grief.
Or, in the few seconds we have left, perhaps joining forces with al-Qaeda operatives crossing the border from countries like Saudi Arabia.
There really hasn't been any firm evidence of that. There were some reports on that early, but the police came down pretty heavily against it. And the FBI is actually joining the investigation, but they haven't sort of gotten in it to analyze yet. They're waiting for the funeral rites to be over so that they can get in there and work in a less emotional atmosphere. Mm. And the only thing we know so far is that the bomb consisted of old munitions, which is also the explosive used in the UN bombing earlier in August.
Mm. Well, Neil, thank you.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Neil McFarquhar of The New York Times speaking to us from Baghdad. Well, we turn now to Karim Saban, an Iraqi living in Baghdad. We spoke to him recently about the death of Ayatollah Hakim, but also about the lack of security in Baghdad and some of the consequences of war. Our conversation was peppered with gunshots from an unknown assailant.
I am in Baghdad. Oh, you listen to this, the shooting.
I thought I just heard something. What was that?
The rebels shooting in Baghdad, anywhere, anyhow. No one's safe in Baghdad now.
Can you tell us what else is life like? What's going on?
The criminals start organized groups. There is a system how they rob people, kill people.
Who are these citizens? I mean, are these young kids that are forming gangs? Are they out-of-work officers? Who are they?
No, this is the people who's Saddam Hussein released them before he's gone.
From the jail.
And this is a bigger problem now. To protect yourself, it's a problem. Because the American, if they found you, you carry your pistol, they will arrest you. If you go outside home with no pistol with you, maybe you've been robbed or been killed. You listen to this shooting. Listen to this?
Yep.
Yeah, it means look like this. In any minute, you get shot. Somebody stop you in the street. He ask you to give him his car, and you should do it. In case not, he will kill you.
What do you do all day?
We stay at home the whole day just for quick shopping and come back home because criminals, it's small kids, homeless kids around city now, they sniff the kerosene, gloom, any kind of drugs, and they doing terrible things.
We understand that this is really an increasing problem, young kids sniffing glue, because it was a crime punishable by death under Saddam Hussein.
Even 12 years, the girl, she's a prostitute now, 12 years old. This has never happened in Iraq. For us, this is it's big shock. It's not normal to see 12 years old girl, she's a prostitute. That's not normal here.
In fact, I understand that drug addiction has grown 75%, according to one Iraqi doctor, and that right after the war, that a lot of the pharmacies were looted so that there's tons of barbiturates and other pills and drugs on the street.
No, no, this is actually one reason, but the real thing is the traders or criminals start smuggling.
I'm sorry, Karim?
There is shooting, yeah.
You've got to be completely on edge.
It starts to be normal for us.
Oh, I heard that.
You heard that?
Yeah.
It means this is each minute it's happening, and you don't know when you get shot.
Well, you know, some would say that this is just a necessary side effect to removing Saddam Hussein, that life is better without Saddam Hussein, and it will get increasingly better.
You know, I did say it, but when I upset from what's happening around me, I said, oh, Saddam, it's better if he stay. But it's wrong. He's not better, but he controls these people. This one, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
It means these people, 1 year ago, all of them in jail. Anyone kill anyone, he hanged him. But now they misunderstand what means freedom. They understand it's a freedom, do what you like. 12 people, they found them inside house after the neighbors heard shooting. They go inside, they saw 3 gunmen, they run away, and they found children, women, and people inside home. 12 people, the whole family, being killed. Mm-hmm. And terrible video there is. I saw the video. It is terrible. Mm-hmm. That's unusual anywhere. But now in Baghdad, it's happening every day. At the past, Saddam Hussein hanged them directly. I'm sorry, it's not human, but it is the best way to control these people, because here it's no real life, no security at all.
Well, Karim, we wish you well.
Inshallah, as Iraqis say.
Inshallah.
And always it's my friend, my Bostel, it's my friend everywhere.
Karim, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Inshallah, God willing. And Karim Saban speaking of his pistol being his friend in a post-war Baghdad. The price of plywood is going through the roof, up from early August when it was already the highest in 4 years, and the war in Iraq may be partly to blame. According to the industry magazine Random Lengths, there are several reasons for the increase in costs, including plywood factory and mill closings last spring when prices were low, and wet weather, which makes it hard to log. But the tipping point came when the U.S. military ordered some 750,000 sheets of plywood, enough to fill 300 railroad cars, to build flooring for tents in the Middle East. Joining us on the line is Bob Snyder. He's project manager for ECI Custom Homes in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Bob, have you seen prices soar or plywood in short supply?
We haven't seen the short supply, but we've certainly seen the prices increase. Mm-hmm. I really was surprised when I went back through just how sharp it has gone up, especially in the last couple of months.
Yeah.
We expect some seasonal changes, but these increases have been well beyond that.
Can you give us an average?
Last December, we were paying about $5.50 for the plywood you would use on the walls or the roof of a home. And we have seen that price more than double. The last invoice I received in August is $11.43.
Yeah. Well, what does this mean, for instance, for home builders who might have made their contracts to build homes before this price surge?
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. We get caught in the middle in that we don't have an opportunity to increase our sales price to the end consumer. We have no choice but to just take it from our bottom line. Even on a speculative home where you don't have a contract, the market will still not allow the increase. You'll still be locked into the prices of the homes around it.
Right.
So there's really no opportunity to move that sales price.
So what do you think about this speculation that one of the reasons that the prices have gone up so much is because of the military spending?
Well, 750,000 sheets, I would imagine, is a pretty good chunk. It's hard to understand, though, if there's that much demand, why there'd be plant closings, et cetera. Certainly, it's been a wet year, but that's also delayed how much plywood that we could knock on the walls. So, I don't know. We've seen this in other areas as well. Sheetrock a couple years ago, shingles in the last year. It seems like different markets at different times just ramp up exorbitantly.
Do you think that the market is just looking to raise the prices because they went to lows months ago and there were plant closings then? Do you think this is some manipulation?
There's no way for us to know from where we sit. Our suppliers all say, well, everyone's incurring this cost.
Mm.
We can't tell if it's a market manipulation, but this is a pretty exorbitant cost increase.
And one of the reasons given is because of a shortage. Do you see the shortage?
We've not seen a shortage. We've had no problem with supply.
Hmm. One of the other factors mentioned is hurricanes. You know, after a hurricane, it's really tough to get a hold of plywood, and we're entering a season, aren't we?
Yes, we are. In fact, that's the only time that we've seen in the last, I'd say, 7 to 10 years, true shortages where there absolutely just wasn't any plywood to be had. There's just so much used so fast. But, yeah, God forbid that we would see something like that in the next month or two.
I'm in trouble. Well, Bob, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bob Snyder, project manager for ECI Custom Homes in Raleigh, North Carolina. And Just ahead, we talk to a high-tech worker out of work for over 2 years. That's coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Millions of Americans, more than 9 million, are out of work this Labor Day, and one in five of the unemployed have been that way for more than 6 months. That's the highest level of long-term unemployment since 1983. Even though the U.S. economy is technically in recovery, the nation continues to lose jobs every month, and wages in the U.S. are rising more slowly than inflation. Last week, U.S. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao predicted that job creation would soon improve. And on NBC's Today show, she defended the president's record on the unemployed.
The president has extended unemployment insurance benefits 3 times already. And if it were not for the tax cuts in 2001 and currently that was just passed in the president's jobs and growth plan, the recession in 2001 would have been deeper and longer.
Well, numbers and statistics are one way to understand the country's 6.2% unemployment rate. Another is to talk to someone who's been trying to find work and may not even be counted by the statisticians. One afternoon last week, Bill Delaney spent some time with John Malloy. He's highly skilled, loaded with drive, but he just can't seem to find a job.
Well, it's still very much the middle of the day here in Boston, a beautiful sunny day. Most people are still at work. The man I'm walking with, John Malloy, is not. John, how come?
Well, I'm an IT computer person who's out of work at the moment.
And how long you been out of work?
Well, it's been over 2 years, actually.
2 years?
Yes.
How have you been trying to get work?
Well, I spend 7 days a week on the job search, between about 8 or 10 hours a day searching for work.
8 or 10 hours a day just searching?
Yeah. My networking skills are being used to try to find these jobs, and I'm searching all the sources I can possibly find.
Sending out a lot of resumes, I imagine.
I've actually sent out over 10,000 resumes in the last 2 years.
10,000 resumes?
It's hard to believe, but most of my searching I do on the Internet, and some I do in person, but I'm constantly sending out more resumes. I think it's almost a waste of time at this point.
We've wandered into a lovely park here. Why don't we get off the street and just pull up a bench here. There's something about being too available in the middle of the day, isn't there?
I feel uncomfortable about it, actually. I'm a person who has gone to work his whole life, probably since age 8, doing a paper route. And since age 13, I was doing work through high school and never missed a day of work, never missed a day of school. And that's the way my father was and his father, who came from Ireland. And we're all people who are reliable, who want to go to work every day. And I like the 40-hour-a-week schedule, you know, and I have not had that. I've had a few part-time jobs that haven't really paid very well, but, you know, 4 hours for, like, one-third of the pay I was getting, I can't afford that. And unemployment insurance is all gone, and I don't know what to do. I'm in an awkward situation at the moment.
John, when they compile unemployment statistics, are you even one of those numbers anymore?
Actually, in fact, I'm not, but I found out just a few days ago that my unemployment insurance is exhausted. I mean, I don't want to collect unemployment insurance. I never really needed to, but if it's supposed to be a cushion, a safety net, but it's not available to everyone. And when you're not on collecting unemployment, you're not on the ranks of the unemployment statistics. And that seems to be a flaw in the way that they gather statistics.
You're kind of an invisible man when it comes to calculations of how many people are really unemployed.
But I don't want to be invisible. I want to be counted. It's not right. It's absolutely not right. And colleagues who are in the same situation feel the same way.
I don't know how else to ask this except to say, I mean, is it humiliating, however ridiculous that may be for you to feel that, to be in this situation?
Sometimes I do feel humiliated. It's embarrassing when I meet other friends who are not in the computer field or friends of my girlfriend and they say, John, you're not working yet? Or even my retired parents don't quite understand the situation. We have a lot of friends who are in the same boat as the same situation I am, but some people say, well, can't you change careers? And I say, of course I can. They've known that I'm very flexible and I can do any kind of work, but in this recession, there's no jobs, and people will only hire you for what you have experience with. And there are office support jobs and customer service jobs that are available that require extensive computer knowledge, but they're not technical. And as soon as the people who receive your resume, the HR generalists, they look at your resume and they see technical. If they think you're technical, they will not hire you because they think that you're going to move when the economy gets better and they don't want to put you in a lower-level job because you might be bored. But I pleaded with them on the phone and in person to let me have a job that I'm overqualified for, but they will not consider me for jobs that I'm overqualified for. And I'm hearing the same thing from all my friends. You're supposed to take all your technical stuff off of your resume. And the term that people use for that in the networking groups, they call it dumbing down your resume. And so you take off a whole lifetime career training and knowledge off of, and certifications and even degrees off of your resume, because if you have those on there, you will not get the job. It's hard to believe, but it's true. I've never heard of this happening before. It's very, very unusual.
John, how afraid are you that you could be in this same situation next Labor Day?
I'm very, very worried about it. Very worried. And I will be persistent and I will not let it bring me down, but I'm quite worried about the future for the ability to work, the ability to continue to earn a salary and to be able to afford to live. If you have any suggestions, I'll take them.
John Malloy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Bill. Nice meeting you.
Bill Delaney spoke with John Malloy. John's been looking for work for the past 2 years. Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts. If you have any suggestions for John or any thoughts on the news, the stories, the program, send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And you can mail us the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us where you live. And tomorrow in Here and Now, when a blind man can suddenly see. And you love the movies, but you can't quite name the actor, we look at great unsung performances. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, and they're off, to the primary races. We'll look at the upcoming presidential primaries. And our jazz aficionado James Isaacs has nothing but raves for a new book and its subject, Blue Note Records.
Blue Note is what defines jazz music in part, you know. American music is riding on a blue note.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush is defending his tax cuts against Democratic criticism, telling an audience of union engineers that he had to move aggressively to help the economy. On this Labor Day, the president called American working men and women the strength of the country.
I want you to think back to that fateful day, September the 11th, and what happened afterwards. It was then that the whole world saw the skill and commitment and incredible work of the operating engineers who manned the heavy equipment to clear ground zero.
The president spoke in Ohio, considered a key state in next year's election. Another audio tape said to contain the voice of Saddam Hussein has surfaced. Lourdes Navarro reports from Baghdad.
The new audio tape purportedly from Saddam Hussein denies that the ousted dictator had any role in the deadly bombing in Najaf on Friday, which left dozens dead, including revered Shiite cleric Ayatollah Muhammad Bakr al-Hakim. Broadcast on Arab satellite station Al Jazeera, the voice says, quote, the servants of the occupiers accused us without any evidence of killing al-Hakim. The voice said that Saddam was the leader of all Iraqi people, suggesting he would not launch an attack on any particular ethnic or religious group. The last audio tape reportedly from Saddam was broadcast on August the 1st. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
Israel carried out another missile strike against Hamas leaders in Palestinian territory today, the sixth attack in the past 2 weeks. The target was a car carrying three Hamas leaders. At least one person was killed. More than two dozen, including bystanders on the busy Gaza City street, were hurt. Rough weather is clearing the beaches of Hawaii this unofficial last weekend of summer. Hurricane Ximena is bearing down on the islands. Though its winds are getting weaker at 75 miles an hour, they're generating waves said to be as much as 15 feet high. A foot of rain is expected in some areas. Actor Charles Bronson is dead. Bronson made his mark playing movie Tough Guys. His series of Death Wish films are perhaps his most popular. He was also in The Dirty Dozen, The Magnificent Seven, and The Great Escape.
Tomorrow night in the tunnel with all those men, I'm afraid maybe this time I will lose my head and ruin the escape for everybody. So I do now.
Charles Bronson died of pneumonia at a Los Angeles hospital. He was 81 years old. In news from Wall Street, the markets are closed today for the Labor Day holiday. It's 33 minutes past the hour.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is away. It's Here and Now. Campaign season traditionally kicks into full gear on Labor Day. And true to form, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry officially announces his run for the presidency in South Carolina tomorrow.
Well, he has to hope the public takes notice. All the Democratic candidates have been on the hustings for months, but a new CBS poll shows two-thirds of the American public can't name any of them, not even former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, the candidate with the most buzz and a 20-point lead in New Hampshire over Kerry, who was once the presumed front-runner. Well, now it's on to Iowa and New Hampshire, home to a caucus and primary, respectively. And for our D.C. roundtable on this Labor Day, we thought we'd check in with political reporters in those two states. David Yepsen is political editor for the Des Moines Register. Hi, David.
Hello.
And James Spindell is managing editor and political reporter for PoliticsNH.com. Of course, that's the New Hampshire website. Hi, James.
Hi.
Well, the Iowa caucus is January 19th, New Hampshire primary January 27th. But polls show people aren't paying much attention. How about in Iowa and New Hampshire? Let's start with you, David, in Des Moines.
Well, the activist Democrats are paying attention here. It does start very early in both of these states. And so the target audiences are paying attention here. And among activist Democrats, Howard Dean does hold a very wide lead here.
I hear he attends five events in five Iowa towns today.
He's a very busy candidate. He's practically moved into this state in the last year. He's following Jimmy Carter's model of coming early and often to Iowa.
Yeah, Edwards and Kerry and Lieberman are there as well. Dick Gebhardt recently held a pie-tasting challenge. But let's move to New Hampshire, James. Now, we know that it's sort of a year-round thing there, paying attention to politics, especially in a presidential year. But how are people reacting this year?
Like David said, a lot of the activists are paying a lot of attention. And what we're now seeing is a second phase in New Hampshire beginning, moving away from house parties to larger audiences, town hall meetings a number of candidates are holding. And we saw even on Saturday Howard Dean having 1,000 people show up for one event, which is really big for New Hampshire standards.
Well, and bad for the rest of the Democratic candidates because he has pulled way ahead. John Kerry on Meet the Press yesterday said he hasn't kicked off his campaign sufficiently. He's saying he needs to do some work to be clearer. Did he do something wrong or is Dean doing something right, David?
I think Senator Kerry was a little sluggish coming out of the box. He did not campaign here as often as Howard Dean, and I think he enabled a lot of activists to look at other candidates. I mean, it was a vacuum. His campaign has been sluggish. I think his second problem is he has an unfocused message. What is he for? What is he against? What really hurt him was the war. By voting to authorize the war in Iraq, by voting for the Patriot Act, he really alienated a lot of liberal activists. And Howard Dean has picked those people up.
In fact, John Kerry was pretty defensive about that on the talk shows. James, he's got an interesting challenge, doesn't he?
He does. And one of the things that in New Hampshire, anyway, is there was I wouldn't go so far as saying arrogance, but a lack of aggressiveness in New Hampshire. He assumed this is a state that saw his television ads, was very familiar with him as a senator. And Howard Dean would come here, you know, for almost every day.
Staying with the theme of the war, does Dean really have broad party support, or is it just the anti-war liberals who might be angry at John Kerry?
Well, this may be the foot in the door is what the war has been. Everyone had said that Howard Dean was going to go away after the war, and here he is exceeding our expectations, and he's going to move on to the issues before the war that he was brought up with universal health insurance in Vermont and how he's had a balanced budget in Vermont, even though the state doesn't require it. It's a big question, and he's exceeded expectations so far. So,
I think, too, that Howard Dean has captured a lot of the anger in the Democratic Party. You talk to rank-and-file Democrats, and they're really mad at George W. Bush. I mean, they sort of feel like he's there illegitimately. He has not been a consensus-building president. They're angry about that. And Howard Dean has given voice to that. It's what gives him huge crowds in New York City for rallies. And I think you are looking at a front-runner, and you're looking at a guy who other candidates now have to stop. I think it's why John Kerry is headed to South Carolina, of all places, where he hopes that a more conservative electorate will give him a few points for his military record, which is something Howard Dean doesn't have.
Well, but as you said, he does have the message, and I'm looking at some more of the polls that are coming out today. Americans increasingly concerned that things aren't going well in Iraq. is continuing to support the idea of the United Nations having a lead role in Iraq. How vulnerable do you see the president in your two areas?
Both of these states are toss-up states. Both of them will be in play come November, as well as being important here at the start of the campaign cycle. And I think that President Bush is going to have a real tough time here. The Democrats have carried this state every election since 1988, and I think President Bush will have his work cut out for him. It's ironic to me that, you know, how quickly this game changes. Before we were talking about how the economy is bad and that's going to hurt Bush, but the national security issue and the war in Iraq will help him. And now it's almost turning around, that the war in Iraq has become a liability for the president, but here the economy is starting to pick up. So we've got a long way, over a year now, before the November election. So I don't want to get too predictive with anything at this point.
Well, just take a look, if you will, at two last wild cards. One, General Wesley Clark, the former NATO commander, says he's going to decide in the next 2 weeks whether or not he'll run.
I think in both of these states, a credible candidate for president who shows up and wants to be considered will get a hearing. There's a lot of undecided voters in Iowa, and they'll hear him out. But I have to say, General Clark has no political experience, and I think it's very difficult for someone who is a non-politician to get in the game, the ultimate political game.
That's David Yepsen from the Des Moines Register. But James Pindell from New Hampshire, do you think we have an Eisenhower here or no?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, one thing that clearly, there are still more people in New Hampshire that are undecided to support a candidate.
And one last topic, not necessarily a wild card, but I'm just wondering, do you feel that the race of Arnold Schwarzenegger in California is going to overshadow everything?
What the California race has done is to take some of the oxygen out of the room. In other words, the national media is paying more attention to that right now than they are to the Democratic presidential race. And it's one thing that's happened to this Democratic presidential race all along. There's always something. You know, there was 9/11. Then there's the war in Iraq. And now there's Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, it's hard for Democrats nationally to get traction. You mentioned at the beginning how so few Americans know who these candidates are. Well, that's because there have been other things going on in the nation's political agenda, and it's really taken the oxygen out of the room.
Yeah. James,
and it's also changed the way campaigns are run here. In New Hampshire, anyway, the last since this California recall started, a lot of campaigns have been working on building staff. Some of this is a natural progression, but they've really turned inward in looking into building the grassroots since they aren't going to get the national media buzz.
We want to thank you both.
Thank you.
James Pindell, managing editor and political reporter for PoliticsNH.com, based in New Hampshire, and David Yepsen, political editor for the Des Moines Register in Des Moines, Iowa. Still to come, a new book supplies the history. Our jazz critic supplies some of the sounds of the great jazz label Blue Note Records. You're listening to Here and Now. In the fight to keep healthy, there might be very good news. Sorry. Researchers at Ohio State University have been feeding black raspberries and strawberries to animals to test whether they protect against certain cancers, and the results have been promising.
The berries can reduce the occurrence of esophageal cancer by 40 to 60%, and they can reduce colon cancer by up to 80%. And based on this, we're planning to do some clinical trials in humans to see if the berries will prevent the development of cancer in both the esophagus and in the colon.
Gary Stoner, chairman of the Division of Environmental Health at OSU's School of Public Health. Well, meanwhile, scientists speculate that the antioxidants in blueberries slow the aging process. At Tufts University, researchers gave elderly rats the equivalent of at least half a cup of blueberries a day and found improvements in short-term memory, balance, and coordination. Well, Al Bushway, a food scientist, is hoping blueberries will also improve the taste of leftover hamburger. His experiment, combining blueberries with hamburger, was paid for by the Maine Wild Blueberry Association. And first of all, Al, have you tasted the blueberry hamburgers yourself?
Yes, we did a lot of sensory work when we were working on the development of these products, and one certainly does not, at the levels we use at 3.5%, taste any blueberry flavor in the finished product.
You know, hamburger purists are going to balk at this.
Yes, they probably will, but there really is no blueberry flavor in the product. The objective of the initial study was to prevent warmed-over flavor development when cooked hamburgers were reheated, and the blueberry puree does a very good job of preventing that, so that the actually reheated hamburger tastes like more like a fresh hamburger.
Well, now let's stop you there. Warmed over flavor development.
Right. The best description I can give for it is when you have turkey at Thanksgiving and you have it that day, you have nice fresh turkey flavor, but if you put it in the refrigerator and then reheat it, it has a different flavor.
See, I thought that's what cranberry sauce was for. You just disguise it.
That will work.
Right. Well, I had not noticed that myself, but obviously it was of concern in the industry, so you were helping them out on
right.
that level.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the sense of how this hamburger might work? First of all, does it affect the texture? Does it make it look blue?
It does not make the ground beef look blue. We've tried it in turkey, and in ground turkey you do get a gray-blue color. But you don't get that in the ground beef.
And how much nutrition can you actually get from blueberries and hamburgers?
At the level we put in, we weren't looking at it from a nutrition standpoint, but it's one certainly could go at a higher percentage so that you're probably up around 7, maybe 8%. So in that regard, you could get a reasonable amount from a nutritional standpoint.
Mm.
And you certainly get the effect of the antioxidants in that product.
Well, for those who don't want to wait for their food chain to do this, how can someone just do this at home?
One could certainly do this by buying frozen blueberries and taking those home and running them through your food processor or your blender, and then incorporating probably, if you want it to be up to 7 or 8%, probably somewhere between 1.5 and 2 ounces of the puree into a pound of ground beef, mix it in good, and make your patties and cook them.
Mm. Well, as I said, Wimpy would be appalled. Wasn't he the character in Popeye?
I think Wimpy.
I'd rather pay you tomorrow for a hamburger today.
Right.
But others might find health value in it.
That's correct.
Al Bushway, food science professor at the University of Maine. A little something for your Labor Day barbecue. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
And at this time, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who come in late, we are now having a little cooking session for Blue Note, right here from Cafe Bohemia. We wish for you to come in and relax, take off your shoes, and have a ball.
Jazz drummer Art Blakey welcoming the audience to a live recording for Blue Note Records. Blakey was one of the hundreds of jazz artists to record on the label's 60-year history, and a new book, Blue Note Records, the biography, describes the label's rich, fruitful life. Well, joining us in the studio to give us a chance to listen to the music that came out of that history, here and now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs. James, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, Richard Cook's Blue Note biography is almost overwhelming in its detail, so you want us to start with a piece that we're about to listen to. It's Art Blakey and Horace Silver. Now, why these two?
Well, for two reasons, I guess, Robin. Art Blakey's 16-inch hi-hats and sizzling riveted ride cymbal drove more Blue Note record dates probably than any other artist. I'm guessing now, but I would say that he's on more Blue Note dates than anyone. And Horace Silver, with Blakey, helped create what came to be known as the first Blue Note sound. That sound, hard bop. What Horace Silver did was he made melodic, tuneful themes over and over again. He often used blues changes, and he often drew on the African-American church. This is sanctified, soulful, hard bop music.
And what makes it Blue Note music?
Well, because Blue Note was the first to really latch onto this. You know, this is East Coast music. You didn't hear guys in Los Angeles and San Francisco playing this way back then.
Right.
Never.
Tell us more about this label, because I read in the liner notes and we sort of feel we know that one of the things that Blue Note did was decided to be not commercial. They were all about the music and not about making money off the music. So tell us a little more about the history of the label.
The very first Blue Note record date, Robin, was on January 6th, 1939. Blue Note Records was the brainchild of two German-Jewish immigrants from Berlin. Their names? Alfred Lion and Francis Wolff. Mm-hmm. Two powerful animal names, Lion and Wolff, aren't they?
That's right.
Well, you had to be tough to survive in the record business, and they were smart, and most important, they had taste. They knew each other as far back as 1925 in Berlin when they were both teenage jazz fans. Lion came to New York first. Wolff got out of Germany on the last possible boat in 1939, and they hooked up again in New York. They started this record company. And the first Blue Note date on the 6th of January, 1939, was the two boogie-woogie pianists, Mead Lux Lewis and Albert Ammons, okay? Mm-hmm. But then they recorded guys like, Sidney Bechet's Summertime. That was the first really classic Blue Note recording, also from 39. The guitarist Charlie Christian was on the label. Earl Hines was there. And they always moved with the times. Mm-hmm. When bebop came along, these guys were the first to record Thelonious Monk, for example.
Well, let's move along with them, and let's listen to some more of the music. I know you want to listen to Jimmy Smith. What does he represent of the Blue Note sound?
Well, again, he comes up during the hard bop era. Jimmy Smith recorded first for Blue Note in 1956. He started as a piano player in Philadelphia, and then he woodshedded for a year. He rented an organ, a Hammond organ, a B3. In a rented warehouse somewhere, and just taught himself to burn. Jimmy Smith really popularized the organ to such a degree that for a while when you went to Uptown in New York, Harlem, and other urban neighborhoods, pretty much all you could hear were organ, tenor saxophone, and or guitar, and drums bands. It was soul jazz, and very exciting. When you saw Jimmy Smith in full flight, I mean, even now at age, he'll be 78 in December. You know, he still has it.
That's right. And the Hammond B3, we should say, is making a huge comeback.
It has during the past 10, 15 years.
Right, in other bands.
Yeah.
Okay, from Jimmy Smith and the fact that Blue Note, again, took a chance with him, Thelonious Monk.
Well, first of all, Thelonious Monk was seen, except by his peers, as, at best, a curiosity. Mm-hmm. He was eccentric in his personal life. He wrote music like no one else was writing then, and it was otherworldly. Marketed him, this maybe wasn't such a cool idea, but they called him the High Priest of Bebop, you know, to draw people into the tent, as it were.
Monk's 1947 recording of Round Midnight on Blue Note Records.
Yeah.
Well, in addition to the incredible sounds, I do remember sitting and staring at the album covers. There's a distinctive Blue Note look. You've got an album up here to inspire us. This is Grandstand, Grant Green, guitarist with Yusef Lateef. It's got that look. black background.
Yeah, against a very stark field of black, there's the guitarist Grant Green with his eyes closed. He's deep in concentration, looking off into the distance. And in the foreground, his very large left hand on the neck of the guitar. The lettering is in, I'd say, fuchsia, the title. And then Grant Green's first name is in white, and then his last name is in aquamarine.
Yeah, that's a Blue Note look.
And then in a little rectangle, this was what Blue Note was famous for. You see the designation stereo and the finest in jazz since 1939.
By the way, Blue Note, what's that from?
The black keys of the piano on the chromatic scale. When we heard Horace Silver's tune, da, 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 you know, that note, da.
The Blue Note?
Yeah. Blue Note is what defines jazz music in part, you know. American music is riding on a Blue Note.
Well, one of the biggest names on the Blue Note label right now is Nora Jones, 8-time Grammy winner, Come Away With Me. What does it say about the direction the label's going in?
In the current record business, jazz is such a small slice of the pie that you just really couldn't maintain the kind of operation that Alfred Lion and Francis Wolff did at Blue Note. You have to have artists who can support other artists. Mm-hmm. And Nora Jones, I think, is successful both aesthetically and commercially. But because of her, Blue Note can keep giving us artists like, let's say, the saxophonist Joe Lovano and Greg Osby, or the young pianist Jason Moran, or the young vibist Stefan Harris. Mm-hmm. Bruce Lundvall, who's the president of Blue Note Records, has said, you know, I don't want to let Alfred Lion down, and I don't think he has.
I waited till I saw the sun. I don't know why I didn't come.
Here and now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on Blue Note Records, check out our website at here-now.org. And we leave you with another Blue Note jazz classic, Hat and Beard, from Eric Dolphy's 1964 Out to Lunch. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio, enjoy your Labor Day, and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll find out what happens when a blind man can suddenly see. And you love the movie but can't place the actor? We'll look at great unsung performances. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.